So I do share one thing in common with the keynote speaker from this morning is that, with Charity. So I like to curse quite a bit, and she set the stage. So now when I, you know, scream all sorts of profanities, everyone's conditioned for that. And I also fucking hate software. It's really horrible. It's kind of horrible at every level. So whenever you run software, you're running that on a kernel, which probably sucks because you're probably running Linux. And if you were running some other kernel, it would probably suck too. And that's running on a CPU with a microarchitecture, and the microcode sucks. And it's talking to an HPA with firmware that sucks on a drive that has probably more lines of code than you've ever written in your life to power that drive, which is horrible. So it's kind of like a shitstorm all the way down. So the one important thing that we have to do, and I think that this transition became really important with all the agility of software development, is that we need to build systems that people are capable of operating. And that's like the biggest problem with legacy software. And when I talk about legacy software, I'm talking about software that was written in 1980 and 1990, where you have this black box. This was really before the rise of open source. And these black box systems, they just worked the way they worked. And it was very difficult for an operator to reason about them. Open source made that better. But now the convergence on SaaS, you're just sending shit over the wire, and I don't know how to fix that service on the other end. We just trust it implicitly. And if you've ever seen the internal, disaster reports, post-mortem analysis from some of these companies, you're like, I put my data where? So it's kind of scary. So anyway, the recurrent theme here is that ignorance really buys a lot of pain in systems. So instead of kind of just talking about operational systems design, I thought I would come up with like a top 10 list where I count wrong and only get to 8. So these 8 premises, these 8 tenets for designing operable software, and you'll learn that 2 of these tenets are not actually tenets, they're just really horrible, unfortunate truths that you have to navigate. But they're these basic principles. And they're born out of watching people make really horrible engineering mistakes over the last 20 years that I've been doing this. So the first thing is that you really should be designing. So when you're designing a system, that system is designed based on a set of requirements. And those requirements are the ones that are known today. We all realize those requirements are likely marginally correct. They have imperfections, they have lack of foresight, they will likely change in the future. But time and time again, when people try to plan for the future and develop things to handle the use cases that they foresee coming down the road, they cross the line and actually introduce burdens in the software that they write today that are unnecessary. And the bottom line is, you may not even be in business tomorrow, let alone have a software requirements change. So make sure that you're always delivering on the functionality that's required of you today. And this is kind of the fine line between an exceptional senior engineer and an Oracle and our junior engineer, is that kind of that spidey sense of understanding this use case that wasn't described is really frickin' likely. So this is going to come down the road, and I need to make sure that I don't code myself into a corner or design myself into a corner. Those things are what really senior engineers are good at. But I see time and time again, people take on burdens in the software design. I think one great example of this is something like AMQP, which I need to send messages around a network, so I should use, AMQP. It's a really established protocol. AMQP has baggage that you would not believe that's in that protocol. It's great. It's a great protocol. It does everything you need and everything you don't need, and you pay for all of that, right? So the idea is that given your current constraints, you should really design a system that meets those constraints and never burden. So the other thing, and I think that this is... this is something that everyone sort of understood, but when engineers became on call, they learned how shitty they were at doing this. But you should never be left curious as to what your software is doing. When I say is doing, it's like right now. So it's running on some server somewhere, and I vehemently disagree that you shouldn't be able to log into your production systems. Site reliability engineering is about reliability, right? So if your software is all reliable, don't work there. You don't have a job. There's nothing to make reliable. It's already reliable, right? So we've already talked about, and I believe that all software is shit. Your software isn't reliable. Right, and in order to debug your software and to really understand the pathology of the failure in your software so you can fix it, you have to have access to that software running in an environment where you can reproduce that problem. Reproducing problems is really hard. How many people here have spent weeks on end trying to reproduce a failure condition in a test lab? Right, if you look at a production box, it's happening right now. Like, capitalize on that. So classic things in this arena are the idea. I really hate Oracle. Okay, as a company, they make me want to go on some sort of violent rage that would leave me in prison. Their database product, actually, it happens to work. Like, it's a fucking good product, which makes me hate their company even more. But the one thing about the Oracle database that was true in 1997 that wasn't true in Postgres, say, today, or MySQL, say, today, is that when something went wrong and you had, like, cross-CPU latch contention or a lock pinning on a table, like, and you said, am I having that problem? You would say, oh, let me ask the database. And the database would say, yes, you are having that problem, or no, you're not, because everything was instrumented. You could see every single thing inside that product, right? There were the X dollar tables that nobody knew what the fuck they meant, right? Well, people did, right? It was really well instrumented. So many times I see software deployed and you're like, well, the only reason that could be slow is because there must be too many items in this hash table. It's like, well, how many items are in that hash table? Let me give you a new binary for that. Like, really? Like, answer the question. How many items are in the hash table? How many items are in the skip list? How many packets per second are you processing? How many times through the event loop per second did you just go through? All of these questions are really critical for understanding how your software is behaving right now on the system. And we can't afford to repeat all of the production problems that we have. Some of them are intractable to reproduce in a test environment. So you have to seize the opportunity of your shit going down in production and see how it's behaving and be able to answer every question that you need to answer as a developer has to be answered on the running binary in the current situation without restarting it. So that's the challenge. I have D-Trace. God has spoke to me. So there are very few questions. Like, the whole memory footprint is mine while it's running. I can instrument it, point-in-time instrumentation everywhere. I can look into the kernel. I can look all the way up and down the stack. A little hard to look across machines, but I can see all of that. And there are tools on Linux, SystemTab, scary as shit, but you can do it that way. There are all sorts of other profiling tools that you can use to answer these questions when, as an engineer, you didn't have the foresight to kind of instrument the system to answer those questions. But it's really important to be able to answer any of those questions. And when a developer says that their system is instrumented for that and you can answer a question, as soon as you put them on call and they go look at a malfunctioning system, there will be a flurry of commits. Guaranteed. It just happens every time where it's like, oh, I'm going to expose these statistics over here and I'm going to do this. And hey, look, a new private API to ask this question, right? All of that happens because they're blind as a bat in production. So you have to do this. This is really, really important. And these things tend to not have any burden on software. It turns that computers, like, the best thing they do is they count things. Right? So, like, counting the number of API requests and counting the number of seconds that you spent in a certain endpoint or in a certain syscall or whatever it is, that's super cheap. So you can do that and not add operational overhead. There's not, like, a significant amount of bias introduced into the system or slowdown by tracking this stuff. There's certainly engineering effort in exposing it, but it doesn't slow down your production systems. So it's effectively free after you've built it. The third one is really hard. And this one, you can't take literally, because if I say, I want to understand what my software was doing, right? So a class, I did distributed systems research for too long, and then I hated not being able to reason about the world, you know? So we were talking the other day about now in computing. So everybody realizes that like clocks are shit, and nobody knows what time it is. And even on like a single core, it's really difficult to figure out exactly what time it is, because it's a different time by the time you get your answer back. And in distributed systems, there's just no fucking now at all, right? I mean, like, all the systems have different clocks. You know, there was seminal research by Leslie Lamport to talk about Lamport timestamps, so you could have some sort of fake clock that progressed forward in a system. But when you're debugging, you need to know what time now is. And what I've learned is that now is not a time. It's only a sense of urgency. And it's an idea in my children's mind. Right, now is when they want something. That's a feeling. It's not a time. It's not measured in atom oscillations or anything like that. So the tricky part is that your software does a lot of stuff. Right? You're talking about, especially when you get into big systems, you know, you got 10,000 nodes or, you know, 3,000 node cluster. Turns out like one node with four sockets. Really, really fast. It does a lot of things. So if you say, I want to know what my software was doing, people are like, oh, we have logging, we're done. And I'm like, okay. 37 instructions in the past, what were all the registers and what instruction were you running? And they're like, well, I have no idea. I was like, well, you shouldn't, right? Like, that's nuts. It's just too much data to store, so you have to draw the line somewhere. So really, this is kind of magical, and I see a lot of innovation in this area. It costs money to store this information, right? So this is a huge struggle with, Do I log like, hey, I got a request and it took this long? Because that's kind of like the bare minimum. That's pretty lame. Or do I store every instruction in every IOP, every syscall I make? And there's a lot of play. There's a lot of compromise that you can do in this area. So that's what I work on as a product. And so you'll see some hints of that. But this is really, really cool. And it's a fun problem to work on. So another thing, and for everyone here, yeah, how many people here run Linux? Hey, there we go. Okay. How many people have had a kernel panic in their larger environment in the last 24 hours? How many people here run on Amazon or Google? So you should have raised your hands first, right? This shit is broken everywhere. It's exploding all the time. That Venom attack's freaking awesome, though. I don't know if everybody saw that. That was awesome. There's a firmware bug in the virtualization of floppy drives and QMU and KVM, and everybody shared the code, so you can actually exploit from the hypervisor, you know, like into the hypervisor. That's awesome. That's great. That's exactly what I want, is an entire fleet reboot, which is probably happening in various environments already. So when these things break, when you have a kernel panic, there is absolutely zero excuse for not having a usable artifact for postmortem analysis. So when something breaks and you don't get a core dump, you have one problem. You don't have a core dump. Not that it's broken, because you have no idea why it's broken, right? If you have a core dump or you have a kernel panic dump or anything like that, now you actually have an artifact. You have something to reason about. You have something to collaborate on with your peers. And chances are you're going to get about 1,000 more of them that look sort of like it in the next 60 seconds, right? Bugs are brilliant. Bugs are awesome. How many people here have run enterprise systems more than 10 years ago? Well, this is a low number of hands. You're all blessed, I guess. But SANs. I fucking hate SANs. All right? So you get an EMC or Hitachi or you know, a NetApp, and they have this magical failover mode, right? So you can they're redundant, right? You can run two of them. You run two filer heads. If one filer head fails, the other one will take over. Do you know how often the hardware fails in those? Never. It doesn't fail. I mean, this shit works. You know how often the software doesn't work right? Often enough that that's usually the cause of your crash, and it's usually workload-induced, which is the exact workload you're going to place on the other head with running the exact same code. So it's pop, pop. And then the whole thing's gone, right? So it's a horrible, horrible thing. So a lot of these bugs are not happenstance bugs. They are induced by workload, so you will see a flurry of them. So when we have, RabbitMQ crash. It's not that we get to restart it because it's going to go down in flames the exact same way, because it's usually workload induced and our workload doesn't change that rapidly. So you should have stack analysis. You should have core dump analysis. I'll get into some reasons why we had problems with that in a little bit and the solution we had. We just bought something. It was great. If you can buy something to solve your problems, that's so much easier than trying to hire somebody to solve your problems. The other thing is that these are for internal failures. This is for the software you own. So you're running your software in some larger system that you don't own, usually. It's running on a power grid that you don't own. Unless you're Google, maybe you own a power grid. I have no idea. But the rest of us don't own this stuff. There's hardware, maybe there's a cloud infrastructure, there's a hypervisor, you're running in a VM, it's running on a kernel that you don't manage. Whatever that is, those systems are going to fail. And if those systems fail and not your software, the system that you run should regain its original behavior when those problems correct themselves, and it shouldn't require you. So this is where there's no excuse to log into a machine to fix a problem, because if the machine is working again, the problem should fix itself. Your software should self-heal. I hate that term because, if you get shot, you're not going to self-heal. But if you have some sort of failure, this is a tragic picture. I mean, it is Grolsch, but can you imagine in an automated world, this thing tips over and somebody doesn't get their shipment, so factory production is increased, another truck is ordered, and it just gets there. Right, that's what happens. When you're shipping goods, you're shipping goods. So the overall system is not a truck carrying beer. The overall system is the delivery of product to me, right? And I need to drink. So it's just going to work. All of this stuff is highly automated, involving people, but highly automated. So if you have a system fail, you have hard drives fail, they get replaced, they come back up, there shouldn't be work that you do inside your software platform to fix that failure. It should take care of itself. So that is a goal. So it should be considered a bug if that doesn't happen. Otherwise, at 1,000 machines, you hate yourself and everyone else. So these two are not really tenets as much as they are uncomfortable truths. So this is what I learned in distributed systems, is that they suck and it's very hard to reason about them, but you need them, otherwise everything doesn't work. So when you tightly couple things together, you lose the resiliency of a system, right? It becomes very fragile when everything is connected in a very tight way. And fragility is a really big problem, right? So systems need to survive failure. They need to behave in reasonable, rational ways when you have degraded service or degraded hardware. If you have an ISP provider that goes down and goes slow for one group of users, it probably shouldn't screw the experience for everyone. There's some fascinating faults with load balancers in that realm. So SYN attacks, things like that can be inadvertent. On the flip side, when you decouple everything to get all of that resiliency, you've just screwed yourself in the debuggability world, right? You have adopted now distributed systems problems. And to me, this is the fascinating travesty of microservices. It's awesome, right? So turns out storing data is hard, right? So you store data, and having data integrity and having transactions, all of those things are really hard. MySQL didn't get transactions for a very long time. These problems are not really that easy to reason about. If anybody's used a NoSQL database and pulled their data back out of it, the idea of relational integrity, it's not a relational database, but you don't have any. There is so much shit data that people put into these databases and just assume everything's fine. And one of the reasons is because typical application developers don't have the data discipline that has been branded with hot irons into DBAs. I mean, DBAs, the reason that they go through architectural review and schema review and all of these, processes is because when they pick a data model, they have to live with it. In NoSQL, you can pick a data model and your friend can pick a data model with different case sensitivity and you can just not see each other's data and not even know it and then realize the bug a year later and realize your database is full of shit. Right? So those things are pretty easy to do in NoSQL systems. It's kind of tragic. So in microservices, now you have all of those engineers independently making all of these decisions about data integrity, data durability, relational integrity between services, MTRR, right? So like the mean time to recover, mean time to failure detection, your recovery point objectives and recovery time objectives. Like all of these really difficult data operations problems are now decentralized across a whole bunch of teams that don't have traditional expertise in exploring what's reasonable. So that's an awesome world of hurt that's coming to all of us. It's great. And a lot of people just hide behind it. I've seen so many people, and I wish I ran a business like this, where they put data in and it doesn't come back out and then they're like, yeah, it's okay. Where it's like, wow, if I knew that was okay. Oh, dev null is so fast. So this is kind of an unfortunate set of truths. And then kind of the last thing that's always most important, which I think is like a tragic mistake of our industry, and a lot of people actually, they work in this industry because they can make this mistake, is that in academia, people choose hard problems because that's why they're there. They choose hard problems. Some of them aren't even relevant. Some of them will never apply to reality. It's amazing. And that's cool. Some of them end up applying 15 years later and save people, you know, save businesses, right? So it's a gamble. You're making up problems and solving them. And they're hard. I mean, you spend 3 or 4 years, sometimes 6 years, pursuing a PhD to a solution that a problem that didn't exist you made up. That's pretty cool, right? It turns out that we have a ton of real, actual problems to solve. And there are really good solutions to them out there, really good approaches. But engineers just like to make stuff. Just really want to make it again and again and again. So coming back to this, I will always buy something that solves my problem instead of hiring an engineer to solve it. Because if it already exists, I'm an idiot for building it again, right? Unless my requirements are different. And then I've seen just so many engineers just strive to make their requirements different enough so that they have an excuse to build something yet again. So stop building shit over and over and over again, right? Use existing systems. And then if you have a problem, the best way to solve that problem always, if possible, is to erase the problem. Like there's no solution to maintain after that. There's no freaking work to do at all. So I have a story about that. There was a company that we were consulting with, and on their homepage, they had the last like 10 products that were uploaded. And there was a search system that had all that stuff, and they had to update the search system, and there was a ton of traffic on the homepage. And the search system could do like, you know, 60 or 70 searches per second over the data set. Oh, this was a long time ago. And they had like 10 machines. The stuff wasn't going to fit in cache anymore. They were like, oh, we need to grow this cluster, blah, blah, blah. It's like we get like, you know, a couple thousand hits on the homepage every second. And management said that we can't cache this. It's like, for your management doesn't know what the word cache means. Probably, right? So there's like, so let's explore that further. Well, the management says that it has to be recent. It has to be as of now. It's like, clearly, there is no now in computing. There isn't. It never happened, right? So it turns out in a management meeting, we were talking about it. It was like, I mean, could you imagine serving the page like, you know, a minute old? And they're like, a minute? That's now. And it was like, oh, shit, right? Because at 1,000 per second, if you can cache it once every second, you reduce your load 1,000-fold and 60,000-fold if you do it every minute. And they were just like, well, anything within the last hour is like now. It's recent enough. And it was like, oh, my God, right? So it was a whole problem. It was bad. So this is a tale of two systems. I'm going to talk about a queuing system, a storage system. And kind of go back on all the rules that I just said because we wrote this stuff ourselves. So I love RabbitMQ. RabbitMQ is great until it screws you and doesn't tell you why and kind of leaves you in a ditch face down. It turns out to be a really kind of, it's a great example of a system that behaves really well under expected operating conditions and just goes off the fucking reservation when you do things weird with it. So we had a system where we were pushing around 1,000 messages per second through it, and going back to micro benchmarks and not trusting micro benchmarks, all of the benchmarks, we found out later, all the benchmarks for the message volumes in RabbitMQ at the time Anybody guess how long the messages were? Close, off by 10. 0 byte messages. Information theory steps in and says, you don't know shit at that point, right? So it's like, what are you trying, are you frequency modulating them to get data through? I don't understand, right? So when we tested it, once you went past about 1 kilobyte, instead of, you know, 600,000 messages per second, you really got to around 30,000. And then when we had a couple of messages in there were like 256K messages. And then you're talking about 100 per second. I was like, whoa. So we made the horrible mistake of combining our control plane and our data plane in the same queuing system. So the first problem fix was not to fix RabbitMQ. It was to run two of them, which actually was a good idea, because in the control plane, everything is really small. It was very low volume. We never see more than a couple hundred messages a second. It's, you know, structural changes, topology changes, people creating new data sources, not actual data. And then the other one, at least the control plane didn't go down, right? So we solved the initial problem that our control plane, when it went down, I mean, shit really went off the rails when the control plane goes offline. So we fixed that. But then we still had this problem with RabbitMQ. And it just turns out that, like, it just doesn't work. It's very, very difficult to debug. I'm sure it's great now. This was 2 years ago. But one of the problems that we had is that we felt like if we're going to do this, we have very specific requirements for around the data that we're sending. We have telemetry data. And telemetry data has this really interesting property that you need to store it all and look at it all. But if you miss some, the best thing to do instead of like storing it and repeating it is actually to wait for the next sample to come in on the same stream, because it's more recent and more actionable at that point. So we took a very different approach to durability. So anybody familiar with exactly once delivery semantics? And how that is not actually a thing. Like, it's not possible to do that. That is not theoretically possible to do exactly once delivery. So if you are going to enforce exactly once delivery, you need at least once delivery and then idempotence on the client to deal with double delivery or triple or a million times delivery when shit goes wrong. You can do a really good job, but you can't get it right. So, given that we have at least one delivery, what we did is we built message queues. So the one thing that took down RabbitMQ all the time was this clustering protocol. So clustering protocols are really hard. Like I was saying before, with the head nodes that fail, like a lot of times the reason systems fail is because the failover technology malfunctions. It's not because one of the components failed. So we just have a set of message buses, and we publish to all of them, and we consume from all of them, and clients dedupe. And now we can lose n minus one of them, and there are no issues. So one plane ride later, we had a prototype. So I only write code on planes, but it was written in C as God intended, so Erlang can screw off. And one of the things that was really important there is that we were able to design it from the beginning for incredibly high throughput. Where latency was not super important to us. So now we have millisecond range latency, but the throughput can trivially saturate 40 gigabits. You can easily do 5 million messages at reasonable size, not 0 bytes per second. And we put detrace probes throughout this whole thing. So what that allowed us to do is at any time in the system, not only could we instrument the code and instrument the operating system, we could actually instrument the semantic messaging of the queue. I can see when a message is received. I can introspect the message. I can look at the routing information. I can look at the latencies. I can look at all of that, because all of that semantic meaning of the queue, instead of having arbitrary C functions that take weird parameters, I actually have this concept of a message, and it goes through like established probe points in the software. And you can do this sort of thing with SystemTap as well. It's just not as good. So we kind of addressed all of the tenets here. So one of the things that we were really important, one of the reasons we didn't use ZeroMQ, for example, is because, shit, everything breaks. It breaks all the time. Like, stuff is horrible. And you want to be able to debug it. So the idea of sending everything through a broker allows a point of introspection that is incredibly valuable to developers. Like in the last talk, it was like, hey, when you go look at the protocol and see all the bytes going back and forth, you learn how fucked up your shit is, right? It's a mess. And if you don't have a point in the network to actually look at this stuff, you kind of lose that. And then we punted the clustering downstream to clients, so we have never had a clustering error in this product because there's no clustering. So FQ is open source. It's on GitHub. It's written in C. It uses concurrency kit, so almost all of the operations in it are lockless, super fast, and it's written in C, so it's the right language for that because C is the right language for that. Everybody who hates C should remind themselves they run on Linux, which is written in C. So the next thing that we did is we had this storage infrastructure, and I don't really regret the path that it took, but we started out with Postgres. We really understand Postgres. Like I said, I hate every single technology, but I may argue that Postgres is actually on the end of the list of technology I hate. It has really been kind to me. You know, when you're sitting with a therapist and pointing to places on the doll that the software touched you, Postgres is like, it kicked me in the knee once, you know? I don't have to talk to a therapist anymore about it. So what we did is we were storing time series data in it, and one row per time point is horrible. That doesn't scale very well. So we actually hacked a column store into it by storing time offsets and then these arrays of data in them. And that worked fairly well for the data storage and recall. It made things very fast. But the fundamental problem we had with it is that it violated a primary tenet, which was five, which is that a failure in the system should not require an operator to restore the system to its original behavior. So if we had a master fail, the idea of promoting a slave and building it back, you know, rebuilding a slave, promoting one slave to master, rebuilding the old slave, resyncing it, all that stuff, making sure all the clients failed over correctly, the technology just wasn't there. And we had enough Rube Goldbergs in the system at that point. We really felt like that was an unconquerable problem. Understanding what the system did all the time, we actually saw before that with a plugin called pgstatsd, which emanates information about the query, like whether it touched, whether it was insert, update, or delete, how many tuples it touched, and how many microseconds it took for every single query in the system at effectively any volume. So you can do, you know, 50,000 queries a second, and you get a full feed of all of the latencies of all the queries. So you can build really good workload profiling on that. So that was good. So instead, what we built was Snowth. And boy, did we try not to build it at first. First, we looked at Cassandra. And it had operational challenges at the time. It's a much better product now. But it had a lot of the problems where, you know, hey, when a node fails, you can just turn it back on and everything's okay. And it's like, have you done that? Like, when you turn it back on, your whole cluster just takes a shit everywhere. And a day later, everything's okay. But there was that like, whole day you didn't provide service to your customers. That was a problem. That has improved dramatically in that product, so that's not really an issue much. But it's kind of like that classic example of not understanding the operational mechanics of a system. Like my database is really fast, but I never tested it while a backup was happening. And it turns out I have to take backups. So when you run a backup, now the system performance goes down the toilet and nobody knew, right? So distributed systems, especially with data replication, have some really interesting performance pathologies in that realm. So what we did is we didn't want to solve a lot of those problems. We looked at React as well, felt burned by RabbitMQ's Erlang issues. We didn't have a lot of Erlang talent on staff. And all of these things are really key value stores. And our values are not immutable values. They're really time series. And we had some grand visions of the future of storing not just numeric data in there, but fully formed histograms as first-class data types in the system. And which we had prototyped with Postgres because it has these type extensions, really cool. But we wanted that. So we ended up building Snowth, which looks like React in a lot of ways. It's a Dynamo-style distribution ring. The big difference is that we require all operations against the database to be commutative, which means that these consensus algorithms that everybody struggle with don't care at all. Right? There's no ordering requirements. I can do everything's idempotent and commutative. So I can apply operations twice and they can come in the wrong order. I just gotta get it there, right? So it's great. And if we hadn't figured out how to do that for our data types, we would never have built our own system. We would have hacked Cassandra or hacked React or something like that. It was because we could do that that we had the opportunity to build a really simplified system. So another thing, which was what I thought the last talk was going to be about, and I was like, oh, crap. But then he didn't talk about it at all. This idea of really instrumenting and understanding distributed systems. So Google has this system called Dapper, which is a distributed system framework. There's a good paper that's published on that. And like many things Google, it never really saw the light of day from a source code point of view, I assume, because it has so many underlying requirements that aren't open as well. But Twitter took it, somebody at Twitter, pet project, and created something called Zipkin. Which takes a lot of the good ideas of Dapper and combines them with some fucking horrible engineering decisions. And, like, Thrift as an encoding protocol should die. Fucking horrible. So we implemented Zipkin in C for Snowth, and we implemented it in Perl and in some other languages. So, like, our entire framework now has emitted distributed tracing information. So we can get waterfall diagrams all cross-service and cross-component, and that's really fantastic. But just as a side point to make you all really hate Thrift as much as I do, Thrift is a binary encoding protocol, and they use Scribe, which is a logging infrastructure that uses Thrift. And Scribe takes a log facility, which is a string, and a log message, which is a string. So you can see, sort of, if you put these things together and you say, well, I have this trace information that I'm going to Thrift encode, and then I'm going to scribe it to a log server, but I have to put that in a string, which I can't, so how do you get binary data into a string? You base64 encode it, and then you re-Thrift encode it, and you send it over somewhere, and at the end of the day, you have actually spent more time Thrift coding and memory copying shit than you ever did figuring out what was going on. So it was really horrible. It was a horrible, horrible experience. We also added dtrace probes into this. And then what we got was something really interesting. And because we support histograms, we can actually see, I always love dog fooding things, so seeing what our system looks like to be able to satisfy some of the tenets of the overall system by building a system that satisfies the tenets. You get like this Inception moment where you're like, wow, that's so good movie. This is what like time series histograms look like, where we're doing database operations. So these are heat maps. So vertically, you have a time slice, and the color density there shows you how many samples were in that time slice. And then when you hover over it, you can see little pop-ups. A little bit better when you start looking at disk latency. I'm hovering over here, there, and you can see the pop-up histogram. You can see that it's like it's truly a bimodal distribution. I've got some really fast shit. I've got some really slow shit. It's a disk, go figure, right? It's got a cache. And you can see all of that. And you can see the workload characteristics change in the environment. And the beauty of the system, of storing histogram as first-class data items, in this whole graph takes about 1 second to load. This one little time slice here has 63 million samples in it, in that histogram. So there are about 8 billion samples in that graph that actually give you a pretty comprehensive picture of the workload and the load and the workload characteristic, the distribution of latencies on that workload over a 2 week period. And it takes about a second to load. And then you can do things like, is that it? No. Oh. Is it broken or did you not update it with the other slide stack I sent you? Oh, let down. So there was a talk on Prometheus earlier, some of the things that you can do with histograms are you can calculate arbitrary quantiles. So you can do things like quartile brackets, you know, show me a 25th to 27th candlestick sort of thing. Show me a workload characteristic where I estimate the number of modes in the system. So we can look at, there's a good article by Brendan Gregg, who's at Netflix, that talks about ways to calculate the number of modes in a distribution. There's a couple of different bad ways to do it. I think his is the least bad of all of them. So you can start to see all of the stuff in real time. And the idea that storing this data, I won't tell you how much it costs us to store this data, but we store this data for 10 years on 1 minute increments. And we bill people about 40 cents a month to do that. So it's incredibly cost-effective to store this information. So this comes back to that tenet, I think tenet four, tenet five, which is understand what your software was doing. I think that our idea of logging things that our software is doing is really limited, and we have a lot of room to grow into that. So the idea of storing the latency of every syscall you do, every single one of them, every single IOP you do, every single remote RPC call you do, every one of them, we do it against every spindle, read and write separated. We store all of that, and it costs pennies to do that because we use histograms as first-class data items. Right, so then we can start building workload characteristics. I mean, the trickiest part of it is how do you receive 100 million samples a second or a billion samples a second? But there's a lot of Google employees here that I'm sure will love to tell you how to do that. So I think that there's a really good way of opening our eyes to how our systems have been behaving that we're not doing today, which is where I'm dumping all my time. But you should build operable systems, because the reason operators fucking hate software engineers is because they get shit that doesn't work. And then they can't ask questions why. So that's it. Unless it goes forward again. Nope. That's it.